Hello, and welcome to the DMV Business Show, a weekly show where we get to meet local business and community leaders in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area. They get to impact their story and how they got there. You can expect to hear advice and learn about their journey and how they went from point A to point B. My name is Otto Sevilla, and I'm a commercial real estate advisor in the local DC, Maryland, and Northern Virginia area. I have been very fortunate to have worked with many amazing entrepreneurs and executives, from startup founders to international Fortune 500 companies. And one of the things I love about what I do is I get to form these great relationships with some interesting people. I get to know them and I learn about how it all started. And I love hearing a good business story. When I'm not working in commercial real estate, I just also happen to be the host of this show. So please enjoy and welcome to the DMV Business Show. Welcome everyone to the DMV Business Show. I'm your host, Otto Sevilla, and today I have a very special guest for you, Margot Thomas. Margot is the founder and managing attorney of the Thomas Law Office. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The pleasure is all mine. So before we go into sort of your personal story, Margot, if you can give the audience a brief general overview of who is the Thomas Law Office.
So it's a group of three attorneys and there are three staff. So a small business, our office, our principal office is in Northern Virginia and in Fairfax City. And our goal is to assist business owners with establishing a legal foundation and resolving disputes with their clients and vendors and business partners so they can focus on growing their business and fulfilling their mission.
Great. So it's all focused on business owners then, right?
Absolutely, 100%. That's okay. Our niche.
Love it. Are you originally from this area or where are you from?
I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, born and raised.
Ohio.
Yes, Midwest.
Cleveland. So what were you into growing up in Cleveland?
Basketball. Sports was a huge part of my upbringing. Both of my dad and my brother both played football, so I was in a lot of football games. I played basketball, so I didn't play at the college level, but just growing up around, my dad was a coach of every single sport. He was a very talented athlete and just learning a lot of life lessons through sports.
Did he also play college basketball? Your father?
He played football.
Okay.
Yeah, he played Division I football.
But you mentioned he was also your coach?
Yes, he was my basketball coach, my soccer coach, my volleyball coach, my track coach, everything. He also was a teacher at a high school and coached all high school athletics as well.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So athleticism or sports in the household was a very common thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What position did you play basketball?
I was a small forward.
Okay. Growing up, basketball was my favorite sport to play, even though I mostly played soccer just due to my friends and them being in the league and wanting to hang out with them and be with them. But my real passion was more basketball than soccer. Yeah.
I mean, I think sports are a great foundation and my kids play a lot of sports now. And I just think it's something great to, keep kids involved and engaged and give them something productive to do. You form so many relationships and friendships that can last a lifetime through sports. I mean, there's one of my best friends, we went to kindergarten together and started playing sports from kindergarten. We're still friends now. So, it builds a connection with people. So,
yes, definitely it does. So from Cleveland, I assume you finished high school through there. And then what happened afterwards? Where'd you attend college?
I really wanted to leave Ohio because it was very... what's the word? I don't know. It's kind of small and, I just wanted to get a taste of the big city and leave the dreary, cold winters of Cleveland and go somewhere else. But for financial reasons, my dad went to Bowling Green and was really involved and engaged with Bowling Green. And my older brother ended up going to Bowling Green and playing football there too. And I ended up getting a scholarship and went to Bowling Green as well. So I was not too far from home. Bowling Green is a couple hours away from Cleveland. So I stayed in Ohio, but I was like, as soon as I get out of this college, I am really, pursuing this dream of going to a big city. And I got an opportunity to come to DC and I've stayed here since then. So.
Oh, that's great. Going into undergrad, Margo, did you know, did you want to do law, or what were you thinking then?
I don't think I was giving it too much thought. My dad was very, very adamant about us being either doctors or lawyers, because he thought that those were like the definition of success. Like, they're the only two professions that like mattered. So I think he was pushing us in that direction. I think I was leaning more towards like foreign service or foreign policy type of, or Peace Corps, that type of thing. But he convinced me to just, you know, go to law school, because it's a good degree to have no matter what you want to do. So I followed his advice and, you know, opened a lot of doors. I ended up staying in the law. I love the law. So, you know, it worked out for me. But if without that suggestion or push, I probably would have not gone to law school and went some other directions. But, you know.
Is that what brought you to the D.C. area, was law school?
Yeah, I went to Catholic.
Okay.
In D.C.
Okay. All right. So you finished law school there, and I guess coming out, do you have a specific focus on law, what you want to do, or you're pretty much open?
I really wanted to do criminal law because I find the issues really fascinating. And I was interviewing at a lot of state's attorneys or prosecutor's offices across the country. And I got a few offers, but I also got an offer at a bigger firm that did civil litigation and, you know, a lot of civil law. And, you know, I had a ton of loans, I had like hundreds of, law school was more money than I could ever imagine taking out in a loan. And just getting an offer from a firm that was going to allow me the ability to pay off some of that debt was very persuasive at that time. So I ended up going, not going in the criminal direction, and taking a position at a larger firm that did civil litigation. And that was my introduction to the law, but you know, it ended up being a great opportunity. I loved it. I never turned back. I mean, there were so many interesting issues that business owners face, and you know, it had not been something that I specifically chose, but it chose me. That's how I look at it.
I love it. And this was all still based in DC, right?
Yeah, I worked in the Northern Virginia office of Miles and Stockbridge. That's where I started doing civil litigation. I eventually moved like directly across the street to Williams Mullen, which is based in Richmond, but they have a Northern Virginia office, so I was still in Tysons. And I stayed there until I started this firm about 7 years ago.
Okay. So you were with another firm for a long period of time until you opened yours, or how long were you doing that for?
I think I stayed with those two firms for about 7-8 years before I started this. So it felt like forever, eternity. I mean, I loved it. I liked the people that I worked with. I learned so much that I feel like I couldn't have left law school and just hung a shingle and had a percentage, you know, a small percentage of the things that I had learned just from seeing people do it and being around like really great lawyers. So that was like a great opportunity for me.
What made you, after 7 years, to sort of hang your shingle, or did you always have that idea going into the career, that one day that may be a possibility?
So it's funny, people ask me that a lot. And I always say, like, I got pregnant in 2013. My dad actually passed away in 2013. And then I got pregnant. And I got pregnant with twins. And I had a very difficult, tumultuous pregnancy that ended up ending in bed rest and an emergency C-section and my kids going into the NICU. And it was a roller coaster, to say the least. But being on bed rest for months on end kind of gave me some time to like step away from work. And that's probably the only time I had ever stepped away from work for that amount of time, and just focus on what my inner voice was telling me to do. And it was always saying, like, you know, there's something else, you know, there's something behind this curtain, you know, and I didn't know what it was, but I just was really trying to quiet that voice for a very long time, because I was like, you know, this is what success looks like, and this is what people think is prestigious, and this is what you're supposed to be doing, and this could be very lucrative, and, you know, just stay the course. But there was always something that said, you know, that route isn't for me. And I think that having that time to step away just made that voice a little bit louder. So when my kids turned 2, my twins, it's when I decided to kind of take the leap and start my own, hang my own shingle, start my own firm.
And how was that? I'm sure it was very different with a 7-year career at a big law firms to then hanging up your own shingle, right? How was that first year?
It was the scariest thing I've ever done. I definitely, they say, where it's like catastrophize something, where you make it 10 times worse. Like, you're just like thinking about the absolute worst thing that could happen. And I'm like, I'm going to be like homeless. I'm going to have no clothes. My kids are going to be homeless. And this is all while my husband was very supportive and he had a job, he was working. And I was like, but I was just envisioning this catastrophe that was about to happen. But, you know, he was very supportive and was like, look, if you don't do this now, you may never do it. If you don't want to live your life thinking about something you should have done or wanted to do and never did. And, you know, you're right. And, you know, when a parent or somebody close to you passes away, you start thinking about how much less time you may have than you think you do. So, and what is it that you want to, how do you make the most of this time we do have, you know? So
it is so true. I can't imagine, you know, having two small children and stepping out on your own, and I'm sure they're non-compete. So those clients that you've been used to for that time, it's not an easy process.
It wasn't. I didn't have a lot of clients because at the time when I was an associate of firm, I was really focused on billing hours, which was the big push, you know, bill more hours. I wasn't networking. I didn't have time to network, especially after I had two kids. It just wasn't something that I really had any knowledge about how to do, but I didn't have time to do it, even if I had known how to do it. And I didn't have a great network here. I mean, outside of the people that I went to law school with, I wasn't from here. I had no family members here. So, you know, it was a difficult push, but, you know, I like podcasts a lot, and I listen to a lot of encouraging, you know, leaders just talk about, you know, taking a leap of faith and burning the boat and, you know, just forcing yourself to do something that you know that you can do if put in the situation where you have to do it, you know?
Margot, I'm glad you mentioned that because it sounds like you were just used to just, I guess, putting your head down, doing the work, billing the hours. And now you're put in a position having your own firm that besides doing that, now you have to generate the business. You have to go look out. You have to go look for the client, whether marketing or advertising or networking and other things that maybe you were not used to prior. How was that as far as that side of the business going out there and saying, hey, everyone, I'm here open for business?
It's terrifying because I don't have a business degree. I've never run a business. Nobody in my family had ever run a business. So it was very new territory for me. But, you know, I think that there is a community of people that you find once you take that leap of faith that really help you and step into your life at the times that you need them. Say things, give you resources. And I found a lot of that. And I didn't even know that community existed because I wasn't a part of it. But, you know, once I left the firm, I just met a lot of solo and small firm attorneys who were like, you know, here's this bookkeeper and, you know, like, use this bank. And, you know, what about this accountant? And people just offered suggestions and gave me their advice and told me what they did wrong. And, you know, I just was a sponge and picked up a lot of that. And, you know, I didn't know how to read a balance sheet. I never had to, a profit and loss or, you know, any of that. All of that was new. But, you know, I think that if it's something that you want to do and spend some time focusing on, anybody can pick it up. It's not brain surgery by any means. So, you know, I just dug in.
That's very true. At the beginning, those first couple of years, where the majority of the clientele come from?
So it was ironic because when I left, I was working on a case that I had worked on for years, a huge business partnership dispute, which is mainly what I do now is work on business divorces, what I call them. And that client ended up staying with me when I left. They stayed with the firm and they hired me and my practice. And that one client made my entire year. And I didn't know that was going to happen until it happened. Mm-hmm. But it was very ironic because that client was a small, you know, they have a huge business now, but they started out as an immigrant that, you know, was two brothers and they started a small business and it grew into something monumental. So I think that they saw in me a little bit of what they had when they started and they were very encouraging of what I was trying to do. And they didn't ask me any questions about why I left. And they were just like, you know this case better than anybody. Like, how could we leave you, you know, and mm-hmm. we want to support you. So that made it, but it's just crazy how that happened because I never could have imagined that they would have done that. I thought they would stay. I thought everybody would stay. I thought I would be on my own and I would have to figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
But
so the relationship, that relationship was very important in the beginning.
It was huge. I mean, I was like, I'm going to have to use my retirement, take out a loan. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to figure it out. But none of that really had to happen because that case gave me some, you know, like a soft landing.
Sure.
I could, you know, dig into some marketing and do some networking and build up a book of business and, you know, get my feelers out there and learn how to, you know, make it rain.
Yeah. It gave you that initial cushion that was needed. Yeah. Now, is it mostly referral? You mentioned marketing, networking, or where is it coming from, the clients?
It's a lot of referrals. I've met a lot of people. I have a lot of conversations. I heard you say something on LinkedIn the other day about just having conversations with people. And I think it's really that simple. It's just like connecting with people. And it might not even be about law, just connecting with them about what they're into, what makes them tick, what they like to do. So it's just like having a lot of lunches and learning a lot about, you know, and even those conversations that don't have a lot to do about law or clients or networking, you know, I mean, I've figured out where to send my kids to preschool, you know, from those mm-hmm. conversations, or, you know, just lots of things that I learned, but it was really just forming those relationships, and that has paid off tenfold, just telling absolutely everybody I know, this is what I do. If you know anybody who needs this service, please send them my way. I mean, that's just what I did. I just called everybody, like, you know, because if they don't know what you do, then they're not going to think of you. And it's almost inevitable at some point, somebody is going to know somebody who has the problem that I can solve. So, you know, it's just kind of putting that out there and reminding them that you're out there. And when you leave the big firm, there's so few, you need so many less clients than you did then to make the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. So I was, and I knew that before I left. I was like, I could just do a quarter of the work I was doing there and make the same amount of money that I'm doing it on my own. Because the overhead is so much lower. And, you know, you're paying yourself versus the big corporation. So.
Yeah. Margo, speaking about marketing, I know that I see you're proactive with it. I'm looking at LinkedIn and you're posting, and that, was that always the case for you, or is that somewhat sort of new?
I think LinkedIn came after. I think the first few years I was really focused on, you know, just meeting people. I used to go on like a billion lunches a week. Was like, I would drive anywhere to go to a lunch. I'd be like, I'm in Baltimore. I'd be like, all right, I'm
oh, gosh.
It did not matter. I would drive for hours to meet people to just introduce myself. Anybody who would take a lunch or a coffee or whatever, I would go. Like, wherever you want to meet at, I'll drive there. So I spent a lot of time on the road and a lot of time not in my office because, you know, those lunches take a lot of time and energy.
Yes.
So I did a lot of that. And then I would work at night. On the actual work, because I was out all day marketing. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of cons to that. I spent a lot of weekends, you know, I was away from my family a lot. It was like having another child. And, you know, that has its repercussions over time. So, you know, I'm not a huge proponent of that. But, you know, it worked. It served its purpose at the time. But now, you know, that I have some relationships formed, LinkedIn is a great platform to stay top of mind with the people that you've met or to, you know, meet new people through that network. So mm-hmm. I do focus on LinkedIn more than I did at the beginning. And I've met a lot of great people through it.
You know, for me, it was sort of similar. I was going to networking groups, whether the evenings, I clearly remember this weekly breakfast group with other entrepreneurs in obviously different fields. I was the only commercial real estate person in the group. And, you know, you're paying for it and you're networking. And I remember after a year, I looked at the numbers as far as my time, my investment with paying for the group, paying for breakfast, and then going out and you're building relationships and going to lunches with some of these members, right? To establish that relationship, to be the go-to referral source for them. I think I got one deal. It was something at least, but that didn't even pay, or I think barely broke even if I remember the numbers as far as my whole time there. And I was like, there has to be a better way. And there were other people there generating business. But I was a lot of B2B because of what I do. A lot of them there were B2C, business to consumers. Mm-hmm. And there was a better way. And then I said, COVID happened for me. And I started focusing more on social media. And then that just changed. That changed my business. And but I was like you. I was like, I'm going to this meeting over there. I'm going over here. I was a little bit everywhere.
Yeah, I did that too. That was one of my realtor was like, oh, you should join this networking group, a breakfast group. I did that for about a year. It was a lot of breakfast. Yeah, that was hard because there was a lot of plumbers and you know, other professions mm-hmm. that didn't quite coincide with the way I was going. But, you know, like I said, I met people that I still talk to today. And if not for business purposes, they've just been good people to know. And, you know, I appreciated that about it. But yeah, I was in your boat. I was everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
So now from the sounds of it, it looks like the marketing, or as far as how you promote yourself in the business, are much different than how they were in the beginning.
Yeah, I would agree. I do a lot less lunches. I'd like to get back into that more. I just haven't had as much time, but I feel like that is probably the most effective for me, is to, you know, build a lot of great referral partners. And I think that lunches are a great way to do that, or even to have Zoom meetings. But, you know, I've kind of gotten away from that just because we've been busier. But, you know, LinkedIn kind of stands in for me. I don't think it's the best avenue. But, you know, it has opened up a lot of doors, and I have a strategic plan for LinkedIn. You know, I try to do all the content at the same time, and, you know, have a plan about what we're going to be posting, when we're posting it, who our audience is, and, you know, looking at the metrics of it. So, you know, I don't do it haphazardly, but, you know, I would like to get back to more in-person focused marketing as well.
I'm glad you mentioned the plan you have for LinkedIn. If you can share, what do you batch everything? What is it that you do exactly?
Well, it starts with a great social media manager that I've been working with, and she has a lot of great ideas about content and how to take podcasts or CLEs, like learning opportunities. Like, I do a lot of teaching for attorneys and how to repurpose that into LinkedIn content. So, that's part of it, because if it was left to me, I probably wouldn't get it done, and it wouldn't be on time, and I would probably procrastinate. But having somebody who's like good at, you know, putting images together and coordinating it all and putting together a calendar is helpful. So she, you know, puts together a calendar for the month and throws out some ideas, and then I can kind of just put my personal viewpoints on them and, you know, make it my own. So
sure.
That's how I work.
And you're posting often or frequently or once in a while?
We try to post every 2 to 3 days.
Okay.
So pretty okay. Frequently.
That's great. And you mentioned earlier your specialty is sort of now a business divorce when a partnership goes bad. Any suggestions out there as far as anyone in the audience listening that is about to get into a partnership? Whether 50-50, however it's split, or maybe it's just a financial back or a silent partner just fronting the money, any things they should look out for and keep in mind going into a business partnership with anyone?
This is also not that complicated or brain surgery. I mean, a lot of the cases that I have no documents that memorialize what anybody agrees to. And I understand this, it's because people go into business with people that they know, like, you know, they're friends, they trust them, they're family members, a lot of small family businesses. So, you know, you're like, I want to start this business with my brother. You're not thinking, well, let me go to an attorney to make sure we memorialize everything that we've been thinking about, because, you know, let's just hang a shingle or open up a store or buy a restaurant. Like, let's just go do it. I know you, right? But personality conflicts are just as common in family dynamics as they are with anything else. You know, lots of people don't like their family members or get to a point where they have family conflict. And if you are in a business with your brother, sister, mother, cousin, it's very hard to get away from them when you work together all day. And then you're at home and you have, you know, there's other people in your family who are weighing in. And I mean, that adds so many levels and dynamics to the conflict. And they don't have anything to show, how do I get out of this? What part of this is mine? What did I bring? Like, how do you navigate that? Because there's nothing that you wrote down before you got into it. I mean, it is so easy to get an operating agreement or shareholder agreement. I mean, they're very straightforward documents that people can just lay a plan about what they think this looks like, what you want the other person to do. And I don't think that that's a bad idea to have that conversation, no matter what your relationship is with the other party. I think it will bring some clarity. It's like being in a marriage. Like, you know, there are things that you think you know about that other person that are not true. You know, like, you make assumptions about how you kind of forecast your viewpoint onto somebody else without them knowing, and not that they haven't bought into that. And I think that when going into a business, you guys need to be on the same page about, you know, which how many hours you think they're going to work. You know, like if they come in on the weekends only, is that going to bother you? I mean, I think you need to have those conversations on the forefront. And I think our job is building that foundation is just to start that conversation and get it written down so that you have that in case things don't work.
That's great advice. Do you recommend for each partner to have their own attorney, or can they just go to one and that one attorney take care of everything?
They can go to one attorney and get a operating agreement together. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a contentious, I mean, we're not talking about a prenup. Like, it's not that type of agreement, but it does lay out the partner's rights and responsibilities. Should somebody die? Should the business be dissolved? Should somebody go to jail? Should somebody just want to get out and get their money back, get their interest bought out? What does that look like?
Yeah, it comes to mind. I was just having a conversation with a client of mine who, two partners, one has very successful businesses that has been run and operating restaurants. Another one has worked in restaurants, but this is his first time. So the first one is backing him financially. They start, do the restaurant, they open, it's going. And then the other one with the experience tells the other one, why aren't you there? Why are you opening so late and this and that? And there was, it's a different business because he started offering liquor and the other one did not do that. So he was explaining to the other partner, my hours are very different from what you're used to in running your restaurant, just because a lot of my business is in the evening with people coming in for dinner and wine and beer or whatever it may be. And there was a little bit of butting heads there. He was telling me a conversation he had, but it's true. Sometimes you do have to clarify and put things in documents.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think that a lot of people, it's not even that they didn't put it in a document. They didn't even have the discussion, you know, and then you have just different ideas of what that partnership looks like. I think it's very similar to an actual relationship, you know, a marriage. It is like a marriage in many ways. That's why I call it a business divorce, because, you know, it has a lot, it's analogous to that.
Yeah, it is. Do you do just that, or do you focus on other things related to businesses, whether, for example, forming entity, or if the business is doing the lease review process? What other services do you provide as well?
So our goal is to be that firm for small business owners. From the moment that you decide to go into this business with a partner, when you get a office space, when you buy real estate, when you know, you want to bring in other partners, you want to sell the business, like any of those transactions that you envision while you're in your business, starting your business until you sell it, we try to be that firm for you. So we do a lot of lease review. We do a lot of things that don't have to do with disputes. A lot of people come in the front end. We do a ton of lease. I mean, after COVID, there were so many people that had lease issues and were entering into leases, wanted to start new businesses. And a lot of people who had businesses that were in breach of a lease because of closures, mandated closures because of COVID. So, you know, that was a huge 2020, huge part of our practice was just dealing with lease issues.
Okay. What would you say, Margot, drives and motivates you?
Drives and motivates. I mean, I love the work. I love being a lawyer. I just feel like people have a problem that they're not exactly sure how to solve. And I love the idea that our firm is able to provide some solutions. I know, and I like the fact that I'm a small business owner. And I started this 6 years ago, so I can relate to the situation of starting and what you're thinking and not knowing a lot. There's a lot of information that you don't know. There's a lot of decisions that you have to make with very little information. And, you know, I like working with people that have that similar vision and drive. I love working with entrepreneurs. I mean, I think it takes a certain amount of risk tolerance to step out on your own. And I like being surrounded by people and that feel that. And I can say I've learned so much from my clients. I mean, they are exceptional business minds, you know, and just being around that, I think is just, it's motivating. It inspires me. And, you know, it's why I love what I do.
That's great. You mentioned earlier that I believe that you said there's three attorneys and then also three other staff members. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. How do you, I mean, I'm sure you just mentioned as far as surrounding yourself with the right people, whether it's clients or even internally with your team is hugely important. How do you go about, first of all, finding the right people and then just putting them in the right place?
That's something that they do not, where do they teach this at? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure this out. I mean, staffing is very difficult. I mean, people, especially in this market, it is insane. Finding the right people, getting the right people to stay, making people happy. Like, I mean, it's not the same. Like my parents, like they worked with the same job their entire career, you know, mm-hmm. Like now people like change in 6 months and just trying to keep up with the trends and COVID, the effect that COVID had on the market is very difficult. So I can't say I figured it out, but, you know, I just try to get people that are motivated, that love what they do, that want to help people. And, you know, that share some core values and hopefully, you know, that shows they show up.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I'm fortunate right now to have a good team, but it's always changing, you know, people come in and out, you know, it's very fluid, I would say. And, maybe that's just how it is in this work.
You mentioned you've had your firm now for many years. If someone were to come to you, Margo, and they said, hey, I want to open also my own law firm one day or another type of business, whatever it may be, any suggestions as far as what they should do first or what they should look out for?
You know, it's funny people say about me, like everybody I meet, I'm like, why don't you just do this on your own? Well, why don't you just start a business? You're great at this. You'll be wonderful. Like, I just can't miss an opportunity to tell somebody that they should be an entrepreneur. And I know in my heart of hearts that entrepreneurship is not for everybody, but you know, I love it so much that, you know, I try to encourage anybody who wants to do it to not be so concerned about, you know, when and how and getting this dream team together and having this 50-page business plan. But I mean, there's a few key things like get an accountant that you know and trust and is good, get, you know, some legal documents put together about what you want that to look like. And then just go do it, you know? Like, that's half the battle, just jumping out there and doing it. And I think that people are so engulfed in the details that you kind of miss the boat sometimes. And you know, there's no surefire, this is the book of everything you need to know. I mean, I think people who probably go to business school don't feel like they have every tool that they need to start a business, you know? And I think a lot of it just has to do with facing fears.
That's very true. Just face the fear and take action, like you said.
Yeah.
Are there any specific habits and traits you feel that you've had that have helped you with your business or even just on the personal side of things?
Specific traits. That's a great question. I always say I try not to make the same mistakes once. That's one of them. Just learning. Another one is learning, knowing when to pivot. Like there are a lot of people are always selling something and there's a lot of opportunities and, you know, you have to make some choices, but you also need to know when that choice is not working anymore. And that's been a difficult road because especially with hiring, like, you know, there are people that you like, but you know that they're not in the right seat on the bus. So this is not the bus for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's hard to have a come to Jesus moment and say, this is just not working. And I like you, you're great, but this is not the place for you, you know? Those are very hard conversations. And, you know, I feel like over the years I've gotten better with having those conversations, but, you know, it's not in my core being to do that. So, you know, it's always difficult, maybe a little bit easier, but it's always difficult for me to do that because, you know, I just want it to fit. I want the pieces to fit together. I make investments in people. And I want them to work out. So, you know, it's hard to cut bait and go another direction. But, you know, I think that's something every entrepreneur has to learn how to do and be comfortable with doing and grow into that. I've had a business coach for a long time. I think that has been monumental. I mean, they're just, sometimes you know the answer, but you just need somebody to tell you that you know the answer. And I feel like that has been helpful to me.
I'm glad you just mentioned the business coach. It just reminds me, I had a conversation with another entrepreneur recently. They have several businesses. One of them is they also provide business coach. The one you have, are they, is that person specifically in law or business, or what is it exactly?
So I'm in a group of lawyers. It's a business coaching for lawyers, and it's okay. A national group. That, sure. So we have a small group of lawyers and we meet once a month. But the business coaches is specifically tailored to the issues that lawyers face and how to grow your business mm-hmm. and how to grow law firms. So that works for me. But I know that there are people that just go to different entrepreneurial. It's not specifically related to law. And I think that the principles, my guess is the principles across the board are somewhat the same. I mean, you need to spend some time working on the business, not in the business. And I think that that's a very fundamental thing that's hard for business owners, because you went out into this business because you were good at the thing that you started. Like, you were a good plumber, and now you have to spend a lot of time not doing plumbing, you know, in order to build this business, which is a very hard leap, you know. You usually love that skill. My brother owns a business as well, and, you know, he loves cars, and he started this nonprofit that helps youth learn skills in the automobile industry so they can get jobs. And I mean, he would love to be working on cars every day. He does none of that. None of that. He's just in an office. He deals with HR issues and building. I mean, they got this $1 million fundraising activity to build a new building and expand, and dealing with investors and grant writing. I mean, none of this has anything to do with cars at this yes. point. And I think that, you know, that's kind of like a mindset shift. And I think that's probably in every business. It's not related to law. It's related to entrepreneurship in general.
That's so true. That's very true. I'm thinking every day I'm working with myself, either landlords who own commercial properties or business owners who are either trying to purchase or lease space. And I come across, especially if it's a startup, if it's a new business, this is their first location or office or retail, whatever it may be. I tell them, I'm not an attorney. I would highly suggest for us to get an attorney so they can review our lease. And a lot of these, especially new businesses, obviously go the economical route and choose not to get an attorney. You being an attorney and doing this, what do you think? What do you recommend? Because that's sort of a stumbling block that I come across. And that's fine. They make their final decision. I advise them. I give them what I think. And in the end, they choose whether yes or no or whatever it may be.
So I think that commercial leases are very different from residential leases. It's usually like a book. It's like 30 pages. And there's all types of clauses that are nothing like what you would do. And most people probably think, well, I've lived in an apartment. I've signed a lease before. This is not that much different than that. But yeah. It is totally different. I mean, the protections that they have for residential tenants in Virginia or D.C., I mean, you can get away with a lot. I mean, you have a lot of regulations that protect you in that relationship. All of that is thrown out the window when you get to a commercial lease. The landlord can just lock you out. Like, they don't have to go to court. They don't have to file anything in most situations. You're signing a personal guarantee saying that if this business fails, they can go after my personal assets. I mean, the clauses that protect landlords are expansive. And it's all governed by contract. They consider these to be two equal business owners, right? Not a tenant moving into, you know, an apartment in DC. It's not the same, right? So you don't have those protections. And most of the people that I deal with just sign. I don't even think they read it. They just skim through it. They're more focused on the end goal, which is getting the space, getting mm-hmm. in there, making some money, starting the business. And I get that because I am an entrepreneur myself. But I don't think that people appreciate the fact that these commercial leases are so much different than what they've been used to in the leasing world. And I mean, I would think that the fact that it's five times longer than the average residential lease would be maybe there's something in here that I should think about. But, you know, I certainly suggest that people spend the time on the front end, because I think everything is negotiable. And if you sign on the dotted line, you don't even know what you could have negotiated. So I think you're kind of doing yourself a disservice with that. I mean, we mark up red line, like, you know, I can give you a specific example. HVAC, right? There are a lot of leases that make HVAC the responsibility of a tenant. In the commercial context, HVAC systems cost tens of thousands of dollars. So if you move into a commercial space, you have no idea which HVAC, when they got it, how it's been maintained, how much life is left on it. And then you sign a lease that says, I'm responsible for, if anything goes wrong, the HVAC. You move in and the HVAC dies in the middle of the summer when you are running your business, it's all going well. And you're like, wait, you know, this isn't covered under my insurance. What, how am I going to pay $50,000 for this HVAC? And it had nothing to do with me. I mean, it just, it's something that people don't think about. But HVAC clauses are something that's negotiable. Why should the tenant in the small business context take all of the responsibility or liability for HVAC system? They have nothing, they didn't put that in. Even when they do put it in, they don't have a lot of say about what system, who installs it. You know, I think that those are the things where you can kind of shift the burden, or at least equal the burden. And people don't, I mean, that's not something that would pop into your mind when you're signing a commercial lease. But having seen a lot of them and seeing a lot of the issues that show up with commercial leases, you know, that's something we can raise and talk about and see how your landlord, you know, if they're willing to negotiate on that. And a lot of them are.
Yeah, I agree. HVAC is a big one. HVAC is a big one. And you bring up a good point. And now that I think about it, especially if it's a startup business, most of them are just used to whether they're renting an apartment, which they don't need an attorney for. They just get a lease and they maybe even read it to just sign off on it and get the keys to the apartment, or they're purchasing a home. And again, most of the time here in this area, there is no attorney. Maybe when you settle a home, but they just tell you here, sign at the dotted lines here, 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 but no one really explains that much. So they're used to sort of these two transactions where there's not really an attorney involved. And then they go rent a space. And like you said, their end goal is just, let me open the doors, get customers in, clients. And they're not thinking about the lease just because it's true. I didn't think about it that from that point, as far as their lack of experience actually having an attorney involved.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a client that owned like an executive office suite type. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're entering into leases all the time because they're setting up new executive office suites and buildings. And I mean, I couldn't believe, I mean, there were things that, their leases were so favorable. I mean, they're like, we're not signing leases that do not have these terms. Like, this is, it's non-negotiable. Like, I'm not signing a personal guarantee, not on the table. Like, I will pay more money, but I'm not going to, you know, the business has been in profitable for this many years. If they're requiring this, we're not signing. We'll go to the next. I mean, and I just feel like people should look at it like, I have some leverage here. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people go into it like the landlord has all of the leverage and I just need to sign. But leases are very negotiable. And as an attorney, I guess I think about many things as being negotiable that others may not, but commercial leases are negotiable and you can make those terms more favorable to you in many ways. And I don't think people consider that. It's like buying a car. I don't know. Maybe people think they can negotiate a car, but they just certainly don't try to. They don't even attempt to, at least in most circumstances.
What would you say, Margot, is your biggest challenge with your role today at Thomas Law?
I think staffing is a big one. I think stepping away from the day-to-day work has been hard. I mean, I still do legal work, but, you know, stepping away and trying to focus more on the vision and the purpose and the future and some long-term objectives is tough for me, but also very fulfilling. So, you know, that's my immediate challenges and goals is just to, you know, think about what this looks like 10 years from now and not just tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I've spent a lot more time doing that and digging in more into the numbers and the finances. So
what do you know now that you wish you would have known in that beginning of your career?
I know now. I've wrestled with this before, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, that I really treated this business as a child for a very long time, and I think a lot of business owners do, and, you know, I don't know how you reconcile that, but I think that you can treat it so much like a child that you really forget about everything else that's going on around you and not giving those things as much time and attention that they need. I think that lawyers are specifically prone to doing that. And a lot of them, you know, they go on vacation. I was one of them. Go on vacation and just take your work with you. And, you know, you're up at night and you're working on weekends. And, you know, I did that for a long time. And I guess I wish that I had known the effect that that would have on, you know, the relationships in my life then. And you know, I wrestle with it because maybe that's what's required. I don't know. That's the only route that I went, and that's how it worked out. And it, you know, I think that it was helpful for my business, but detrimental to other things in my life. So, you know, I guess I would just raise that with people and have them think about that more, because it can be all encompassing. You know, it can be something that you eat and sleep, and maybe it's easier if you're 20 and you don't have, you know, kids and family and, you know, other obligations. Maybe, I don't know, but it's hard to balance, I would say.
It's very true. What has helped me, at least, because I can be doing things at whatever time, is having a partner, my wife, and we have three young boys, and they're like, hey, you know, can this wait? Is it really that, like, do or die? And majority of the time, it can wait. And that sort of shifts in my perspective a little bit. Okay, let me just unplug here for a moment. My time is very limited with my loved one, my family, my wife. Most of the day is spent working, right? And so that sort of helps me, having my wife sort of tell me, hey, let's unplug there for a bit and focus on the family.
Yes. And I think it's nice to have a reminder, someone to say that, because, you know, you can lose track of time very quickly. And with children, I have three young children, and, you know, I think that love is shown through time, right? And my job all depends on me billing time. So it's like, you know, there's got to be some balance here, you know, they need that.
That's true. Coming to an end here soon, Margot, are there any big mentors you've had throughout your career? And if so, what did you learn from them?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think mentorship is key. Like, I think everybody needs a mentor. And I think just surrounding yourself by people that you think you can learn a lot from, that seem to have a little bit more figured out than you, is crucial. And, you know, it's funny that morning breakfast group you're talking about, you know, I met an attorney through somebody who introduced me to an attorney who has a very successful law firm, and we've kept in touch. And I started that the Tuesday after I started this firm, I started going to that morning networking group, and I've known this attorney for the last 7 years. It was probably one of the best introductions somebody made, because he has been just a sounding board for a lot of ideas, and, you know, not really into the weeds, but just very high level, like, you know, what's important here, and just helping with decision making and just process making decisions with a lot less information, and, you know, just higher level thoughts. And I think mentorship is so important to that. And I don't think I would be here 7 years later had it not been for some people that pushed me in the right direction when I needed that push. So, you know, I'm hopeful that I can be that mentor for other people. And you know, I had a mentor when I was at the bigger firms, who I still talk to, who was very helpful. And we've went to different paths and are now, you know, I consider him, you know, up here, and he taught me so much. And he's like, you know, we're both out here now, you know, and I'm like, I just kind of view it like that. You know, you've just given me so much, a wealth of knowledge, you know. So
that's great. When you hear the word success, what does that mean for you? How does success look for you?
That's a good one. I mean, I've been trying to define what that looks like for my firm, like specifically, like how much does the firm make? How many people work here? How many cases do we take a year? You know, what does it mean to reach this goal as far as my firm? And, you know, I don't think I've nailed that down. I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I'm trying to put that on paper so that I have a written goal. I think that's success as far as the metrics go with the firm, once I figure that out. I think personally that, you know, the business can run without me being there. Like, I don't want to consider myself working at a job that's just named after me. You know, I want it to be bigger than that. So, I mean, that's the ultimate goal in the big picture, and that allows me to have more time doing things with my family and doing things away from the firm. Creating something that can function on its own is really, you know, the big picture goal, for my personal goal, and, you know, the big picture goal for the firm.
What does the future look like, the next couple of years, the next 5 years for you in the law firm?
I think it means building capacity. I mean, I'd love to add a few more attorneys. I'd love to add some third, fourth year attorneys that will do a lot more of the court appearances. I'd like to see my role more of a CEO than as a practitioner at some point, and just putting the building blocks in place. Like, you know, I would like to leave my clients in the hands of the best attorneys, and, you know, it's a high bar. So, you know, I want the quality of our services to stay the same. And, you know, I want our clients to feel like they are getting the time and attention that they need. So just putting the people in place to allow my vision of what client service and legal services should look like flourish.
That's great. When you're not busy working, Margo, what do you like to do for fun in your free time?
I'm very into gardening and childhood nutrition. So I have a business, another business called Vegetable Ford, that focuses on helping schools and nonprofits build gardens for children. So I have a whole like grow room in the house where I grow vegetables. And, you know, I think that we can learn a lot through that as well. I mean, I'm very much into sports, but I think that growing food is a great way to teach children a lot of life lessons. So patience being one of them. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and I swim a lot. So you can catch me at the pool most days. I probably will head there after this. So yeah, that's my love.
That's awesome. The gardening, is that indoors?
So it starts indoors around February. And when I start with seeds, I have seeds and have seedlings, and then they get big, and I take them outside, and we sell them and donate them to community gardens. So it is a production, to say the least. It's actually something we got into during COVID, because we had so much time at home. It's something I always kind of wanted to do, and I kind of just was like, oh, well, now's the time. So I turned our downstairs into a nursery. Wow. Small plants. It just kind of got bigger and bigger, but it's something that I really love and enjoy doing.
That's great. So I guess you're trying to show other schools or nonprofits how to establish this, whether inside or outside exterior.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. How to build garden beds, how to teach children about plants. And then, you know, I think it just extends into them eating better and knowing about their food. And, you know, food is such an important part of being able to show up. You know, being productive as a child, you know, you need good meals and good nutrition. And that all starts with seeds that we can grow in our backyard, you know.
What are you growing mostly?
I try to grow things that you can't get in the grocery store, which my kids, I think kids find, you know, it's more exciting for them, like purple celery. And, you know, there's a 100 varieties of watermelons that come in all different colors and shapes, and pumpkins and okra and we're growing artichokes right now. My kids love artichokes, and it's probably because we started growing them, and they, you know, tomatillos, just lots of different vegetables that you might see, but different colors or varieties of them that you wouldn't be able to buy, I find is the most exciting for children.
I like that, especially the purple celery.
We have more purple celery than you need in life. My freezer is full of purple celery. I don't even know what to do with it all, but we do have a lot of it. So, yeah.
You just mentioned earlier, you started this during COVID. I'm curious, how did COVID affect your business at all? And if so, how?
I was terrified during COVID because the phone just stopped ringing and everybody was just at home and nobody knew how long this was going to last. And I was like, this is scary. And I'm sure every business owner was like, it's either going to be really good or very bad. You know, like it just depends on what industry you were in. And I wasn't sure at the outset which one it was going to be. But, you know, shutting down businesses creates a ripple effect. And a lot of litigation stemmed from that. And a lot of people started businesses because of that, because they had more time and they had that opportunity to do something that they always wanted to do. So it was great for my business and the people that I work with, because it provided an opportunity. But at the same time, it, you know, it closed a lot of businesses. So, you know, it's a gift and a curse, I guess. But I think COVID was the best year that we had as far as finances, because of all that, the ripple effect having to do with small businesses.
I'm happy to hear that it helped your business in a positive manner. It is true. It's unfortunate. Some businesses didn't make it. But, you know, everyone's different. I'm glad that it went the opposite way for you and it went very well and you did your best year yet.
How did it affect your commercial real estate?
Great question. So I would say probably the first 30 to 90 days, it was crickets. It was dead. And I'm just like, gosh, what's going to happen? And, you know, luckily with me, I wasn't very worried too much just because I know everything's cyclical, especially with commercial real estate. I'm like, we're going to come out of it. It's just a matter of when. And that's actually when I started the DMV Business Show. And I opened it. Now we're going into our third season. I've always thought about this as far as having a local show, just highlighting just all local people in the DMV area. But then with cameras and all this, and then I started, I didn't really put that much attention to it. I was just focusing on the business. And then I started hearing the Zoom with COVID. I'm like, what's the Zoom, people? And I researched, I'm like, this is perfect. Less friction. And now it could happen. And then I stood up the DMV Business Show, and I should have started earlier. It's the best thing I've done. And I love it. But business, like 90 days later, started coming around, and now it's just been up. So it's been great.
Well, it sounds like you've been very consistent with it. I mean, you have 100 episodes or more?
Yes. Yeah. Now we're over 100 episodes. That's right.
Wow. How do you maintain that? I'm curious.
I see it as sort of a marketing arm, even though I never push anything what I do, but people obviously would know what I do coincidentally, but it's just a way to continue to put content out there. Just because people who need my services, commercial real estate, these business owners need me once every maybe 5 years, if that. And so therefore me talking about commercial real estate, hey, look into HVAC you mentioned, or right of first refusal, or signage, or whatever it may be, it's going to bore them after a while. And so just talking about business in general, marketing or sales that every business owner incorporates on a day-to-day basis is just, okay, maybe it may be useful for them, maybe not, but it's just another way to provide content and at the same time highlight another local business owner. I think it's just a win-win-win for everyone. The guest, they can promote themselves to show, and just a way also for me just to continue to be out there. But it does take time, and this is not what I do. My business is commercial real estate. This is just sort of the marketing side of things. I guess this is replacing my breakfasts that I used to do, per se.
Yes. Well, it's great. I mean, I think it's such an asset to have, you know, your show for, you know, highlighting small businesses. It's wonderful. I don't think there can be too much of that. And just to see your consistency in doing this is also inspiring, because, you know, lots of people start things and don't finish. And it's tough to keep that consistency.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, it is. It's not easy to put out new episodes and clip them and all this, but it's well worth it for sure.
Wonderful.
So if people want to reach out to you, Margot, want to learn more about you and the law firm, where can they go to, please?
I'm very accessible. Our website, thomaslawplc.com. I'm very accessible via email, mthomas@thomaslawplc.com, and or just pick up the phone, 703-957-2577. I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm on all the social media channels, so it's not hard to find me. And I'm happy to answer any questions anybody has about, you know, legal issues. And I have a lot of content on education, having to do with, you know, leases and business partnership disputes, and I'm happy to share that with anybody who wants it or needs it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Pleasure's all mine. Bye.
If you haven't done so already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and leave a review and comment and let me know what you think. Thank you, and I'll see you all very soon on the next episode.